Okay, so today I'm with Armin, and we're discussing the South Sudan. So in the last bit of our series, we had Leslie Ann Warner to sort of give us a view, 20,000 feet above the situation, sort of view, and sort of begin to understand the dynamics of what exactly is going on in South Sudan. Today, Armin just came back from a trip from South Sudan, and will sort of give us sort of the ground view and sort of what it means, you know, for South Sudan, this newly independent, relatively newly independent country, and, you know, it's sort of fight for carving out a space, so to speak. I want to start off with Armin. You just came back from a trip from South Sudan, and I want you to, if you can, sort of compare what it's like today versus what it was like 2 years ago when you sort of last went there.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me back on. I don't know how many people have been on the Loopcast 3 times by now, but I'm sure I'm in some very rarefied company here. Anyway, so 2 years ago, I was there about 8 months after South Sudan became independent. And there were really two kind of big issues that were on everybody's mind. The first, obviously, was just the novelty of independence, right? I mean, the country had emerged from over 20 years of war, really 50 years of war, on and off. It had endured this very kind of, this interim period in which it was unclear whether there would ever be a referendum vote, whether they'd ever have the chance for independence. And now, after all of this, the country is finally kind of free to chart its own course, despite all the challenges it faced. And then the second big issue was the North. All of these outstanding issues with the Republic of Sudan over things like the split in oil revenues, the border, you know, disputed areas like Abyei, the fact that both countries were supporting each other's rebel groups on other sides of the, you know, on the opposite side of the border in an attempt to destabilize one another. It was issues like that that were on people's minds. This time around, the only issue on people's minds are all internal. It's really all about the viability of the state, whether it can kind of make it through this very tough period of civil conflict verging on outright civil war. Questions of, you know, these very thorny questions of forging a national identity that can include everyone, of getting past, you know, this ethnicized conflict that kicked off on December 15th, which I don't think was an ethnic conflict to begin with, but took on the characteristics of one kind of as, you know, the armed opposition coalesced. And just questions of really the stability and I guess, you know, coherency and integrity of the state, which in a way are harder issues. It was very easy 2 years ago to kind of use the North, you know, as a means of uniting South Sudan, both the memory of the war against the North and the reality of a kind of strong, hostile neighbor that the country could, you know, the country's various peoples could unite against. Now the issues with the North are still there. They haven't gone away. But the country is really going through kind of a very rough sort of reckoning. Over, you know, a lot of very fundamental issues. So those were the big kind of top level differences. You know, kind of on a nitty grittier level, a lot of the issues have actually kind of stayed the same. There isn't a lot of infrastructure. There isn't a lot of capacity that's been built. When I was there 2 years ago, a lot of people in government weren't getting paid because of an oil shutoff. The South voluntarily shut off their oil supply because of a dispute with the North over transit fees. This time around, people weren't getting paid, but it was because the rebels hold on to territory and it's interrupted sort of markets within the country and threatened the oil flows, which has also cut into public sector revenue. I think in Juba, there's been a bit more development, perhaps, than there was 2 years ago. A lot of high rises, although it's kind of unclear what they're really being used for. On the other hand, in northern Bahr el Ghazal, I was in a place this time around very close to another place I got the chance to visit for a few days back in 2012. In northern Barl Ghazal, it's unclear there's really been any development of any kind in the last 2 years. I'm sure that's really kind of shortchanging it, but you know, they still depend on you know, sorghum shipments from the north to feed people. It's still a place with very little productive capacity. Civil servants aren't getting paid. Schools are still meeting underneath trees instead of in actual buildings. It's still desperately kind of isolated and poor. On the other hand, considering all the challenges that the country has gone through, not just since independence, but over the last 30 years, you know, there's a larger question of what sort of the expectation should be at this point. Whether it's, you know, whether it isn't too early to be expecting, you know, a major change after, you know, a period of horrific warfare and now sort of the internal instability of the past few months. And that's a question that, you know, I can't really quite answer at the moment where the country should be. But just from what I've seen, it hasn't taken any steps back, but it hasn't necessarily moved forward at a blistering pace either.
You said there was a reckoning. I mean, do we consider sort of the split of South Sudan from North Sudan the reckoning, or do we consider sort of this, you know, this power struggle that sort of evolved from December of 2013 till now? I mean, what do we, I mean, are, you know, are these sort of two things not only interrelated but simultaneous?
Well, I don't know if they're necessarily interrelated. I mean, I guess they're interrelated in the sense that the independence from the north sort of made. I mean, it's the case with, you know, any new state where the crucial issue is responsibility. It's the idea that there's no longer an occupier or an enemy that you can blame. You know, the blame for any failure has to rest squarely on you. That's the entire idea of statehood in a way, of self-determination. It's assuming responsibilities that other people kind of had. The big reckoning in my mind doesn't even really necessarily have to do with the split between Riak and Salva Kiir. I mean, the alarming thing about what happened in December is that it began as an internal dispute within a single political party between two people. And within 3 days, it had turned into a national-level crisis with an armed opposition, with clear battle lines, and with major cities, including the capital, under threat. I mean, I had multiple people tell me, I mean, this is kind of conventional wisdom at this point, that if the Ugandans had not intervened early on in the conflict to do things like recapture the city of Bor, to reinforce the airport and crucial infrastructure inside of Juba, that the capital would essentially have burned to the ground, and Riek Machar would probably be president at this point. So the reckoning that I'm talking about is the fact that within a healthy country, and even within most unhealthy countries, you don't go from, you know, the point A of an internal dispute between two people, you know, to the point whatever, you know, of a nationwide crisis that quickly, right? You only get that kind of deterioration only happens, you know, within a sort of political and social atmosphere of, or rather sort of a political and social context where a lot isn't going right to begin with. And the chief kind of example of this is the speed with which it became kind of an ethnic issue. I mean, you'll recall that the day after the alleged coup, and by the way, nobody seriously believes it was a coup, and there's very little evidence, almost no direct evidence of a coup. I mean, the day after the alleged coup, in which Salva Kiir went on TV in his military uniform and talked rather explicitly about the Nuer Dinka conflict of the early 90s, which was a kind of wink and nudge sort of ethnic incitement. Stuff like that doesn't happen within healthy political systems. At the same time, you wouldn't have an ex-vice president who is willing and capable, you know, of waging a potential national-level insurgency you wouldn't have someone that close to power and healthy system either. And at the same time, in a country where there's sort of a strong sense of national purpose and national identity, in which sort of the different social and political blocks have been reconciled with each other, and you have a more or less kind of common view of how to move forward. Right. I mean, a civil war doesn't happen as easily in countries like that. But the trouble is that in the post-independence period, there's been so little grounding for a South Sudanese national identity. And the government has done sort of so little to channel, you know, the energies of and the optimism of the independence period that I don't want to say that something like this was bound to happen. But it created a kind of vacuum that could potentially be filled by, you know, the sort of chaos we've seen over the last few months.
But, I mean, it almost seems that you're saying that the roots of this sort of opposition and this sort of rebellion that happens in 2013 is much more, it's deeper than the sort of the initial split of North and South, but rather it goes back to maybe 2005, 2004.
Well, it goes back arguably. I mean, it's interesting. I interviewed Dr. Pauline Riok, who's the executive director of the Sud Institute, which is sort of the first South Sudanese think tank. And when I asked her about, you know, to explain kind of the ethnic dimensions of the conflict, she said, well, you have to go back 250 years. So it goes back in a way to sort of historical, you know, just the your general kind of run-of-the-mill conflict between different pastoralist groups. In this case, the Nuer and Dinka. It goes back to in the early 90s when Riek Machar attempted to overthrow John Garang as the head of the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement. And it was kind of a parallel situation to what happened this past, well, not exactly a parallel situation. In the early 90s, he believed that if he defected from the SPLM, that everyone else would defect with him. And sort of vastly overestimated how much support he actually had. You could argue that something similar happened in December, but maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. I mean, the most plausible sociological explanation for this is that in the absence of a strong theory of national unity and in the absence of a strong state and of any real organic sense of patriotism, right, people turn to their tribes in the same way that, I mean, the way it was explained to me is that people turn to tribe in the same way that people in Britain would turn to social class, or that people in America might turn to, I don't know, I guess the city you're from. I mean, think of what, you know, kind of the next level of identification would be for you, you know, beyond being an American. When you don't have that kind of top level commonality, you fall back on whatever the next strongest thing is. And in South Sudan, that happens to be ethnicity or tribe. This is interestingly kind of one reason to be optimistic about any future kind of peace and reconciliation process, right? I mean, there isn't hostility between Nuer and Dinka because, you know, it's some sort of built-in, you know, hatred between the two. It's because of kind of a lack of anything else that people can lean on. I mean, interestingly, there's been a lot of like support for the government at this point across ethnicities. I mean, the armed opposition is almost completely Nuer. There are Nuer who have actually stayed with the government, including, you know, generals in the SPLA and cabinet level cabinet ministers and so on. I mean, it really just might be an instance of, you know, people falling back on an identity for lack of anything sort of better to you know, or anything stronger to unite point.
Interesting. I'm sort of curious. I mean, if you can sort of walk us from the rebellion, the initial point in December 2013 to now, and to sort of describe, you know, what has happened in those in that sort of 4 or 5 months from the end of last year to today.
I mean, okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
So on December 15th. There are a number of theories of what actually happened. One theory is that there was a sort of confrontation between React Machar's Nuer bodyguards and President Salvakir's Dinka bodyguards at a meeting of the SPLM earlier that weekend. I don't know if this is true. One very highly placed source says it was true. Another equally highly placed source said that nothing like that occurred whatsoever. Point is, there was some kind of a precipitating event that caused tension between the Nuer and Dinka cadres in an army division called the Tiger Force, which is in a barracks not far, sort of on the outskirts of Juba, not far from one of the major UN bases. That led to some kind of an event in which the Nuer had their weapons taken away. The Nuer tried to confiscate weapons from the Dinka. There was some kind of eruption within the Tiger Force that spilled out onto the streets. At some point, either the presidency or someone either thought there was a coup going on or wanted to create the image of a potential coup in order to clean house within the SPLM. At some point, that turned into a general order to just sort of go and round up Nuer and kill Nuer on the streets. I mean, it's believed that several thousand Nuer were killed inside of Juba in the first 3 days after whatever the heck happened on December 15th. And there's a whole backstory to the events leading up to December 15th, including, the firing of the entire cabinet, the firing of Riek Machar, and a kind of larger debate within the SPLM about internal reforms leading up to the passage of a new constitution and elections in 2015. But anyway, those tensions couldn't be contained. They were expressed through this conflict within this one military division inside of Juba. That conflict eventually spilled out into an ethnic conflict within Juba itself. At some point, Riek Machar actually left town. I mean, this is one of the reasons that it probably wasn't a coup, right? If you're running a coup, you have to stay in the city to declare victory once you eventually kick out the existing government, right? Riek didn't do that. He fled fairly early on. The fighting began at night. It began at 10 p.m., which is a very awkward time to start a coup in Juba. It's almost impossible to fight at night. And defections, you know, the kind of defections that Riek would have expected had he had a coup, the idea of a coup, didn't really happen until a few days later. I don't think Peter Gaudet defected until a few days after December 15th, although I might be wrong about that. One way or another, both because of the heavy-handed response of the government in Juba to whatever internal disorder broke out on December 15th, and because Riek is one of these kind of mercurial figures, as I mentioned before, he defected from the SPLM once before in the early 1990s and only rejoined in 2002. So this is a guy who has always kind of fancied himself the real leader of South Sudan. But because of Riek's ambitions and the government's heavy-handedness, Riek managed to sort of form the center of this rebellion in Upper Nile State, which is in the northeast, and Zhongli, which is right below that. Unity State, which is sort of right to the west of there. He was able to mobilize, and this is where it starts to get really complicated. Most of the rebels, as we think of them, are this group called the White Army, which is this rabble of about 20,000 or so really pissed off Nuer youth. In fact, a lot of sort of the NGO and international types in Juba don't even really call it the White Army. They just call them the Nuer youth, because calling them an army connotes, you know, command and control and discipline and all these other things that they just don't really have. When Malakal was taken a couple of weeks ago, it was basically taken by, you know, these human wave attacks of thousands and thousands, you know, White Army, some of them carrying spears, knives, things like that. Machar is sort of the most prominent of these figures in the armed opposition, but the opposition also includes this rabble of Nuer youth. It includes defectors from the SPLA who might not necessarily listen to Riek. The government itself estimates that 70% of the SPLA is defected. 70%. And people in Juba who I consulted consider this to be a plausible figure. And you'd wonder, why would the government be publicly sharing the fact that 70% of their army has just left? The answer is that the army has had a lot of trouble fighting the rebels in places, including Malakal. And it's kind of it serves as kind of an excuse for that. It's a way of explaining why the rebellion hasn't been defeated, why they're having such trouble. It explains why they're taking military losses in certain places, why they're kind of refocusing, assets around the oil fields in Upper Nile State, which are now the most heavily guarded places, I've been told, in all of South Sudan. So really, again, what began is really this very kind of internal thing about reform within the SPLM. Gradually, because of miscalculation and the personalities involved and the fact that it took on ethnic characteristics very quickly, has turned into something much larger. The other thing is that, as I've sort of mentioned over the course of this answer, is that command and control within the rebels is a very complicated and perhaps non-existent thing. There's a story, which I believe is public, about a plane that one of the major NGOs sent to, somewhere in Unity State. I might be wrong about that. It was either somewhere in Unity or Upper Nile. And the plane landed in the wrong airfield, and it was painted red. And apparently there is a New Era prophecy about a red cow or a red cart that, will be sent to reinforce the enemy or, something like that. So a division of the White Army or some group of White Army newer youth seized the plane and refused to give it back. And the NGO had to open up a line of communication with the rebels, who then had to open up a line of communication with the White Army who had taken the plane, and they refused to give it back. So the plane is still on, the airstrip in Lier in Upper Nile State. Partly because of the complete lack of command and control between the rebels and the White Army, the foot soldiers, the people who are kind of supposedly on their side. It's a pretty kind of tough situation. I suppose one kind of silver lining here is that the rainy season is coming and the current kind of battle lines are going to be frozen in place for a while, which buys time for the political process in Addis Ababa, which, there's reason to at least be optimistic the government is taking it seriously. Although, again, it's unclear what kind of authority, the people negotiating on behalf of the rebels really have. And in the meanwhile, even since the ceasefire was signed a few weeks ago, a ceasefire which was violated almost as soon as it signed, there have been some really kind of horrific acts of violence. There was a massacre of hospital patients in Malakal in late February, which took place actually a few days before I arrived, perpetrated by the White Army, which we know when it swept through the city. I spoke with sort of Western NGO staffers who have been to Malakal since the government had left. Apparently it's a ghost town. This is the third or fourth biggest city in the country. It's almost completely depopulated. Apparently when NGOs want to go into the city, they have to have, armed escort. They have to have UN soldiers with them for their own protection. Apparently there's one NGO that has had the entrance to one of its warehouses in Malakal mined, and they have no access to, whatever they left behind in the city. The NGOs working there are limited, to within a couple of UN compounds, which of course makes it a lot more difficult to reach people who, might be in need of help when the rains hit. So at least in parts of the country, it seems to be a pretty desperate and deteriorating situation, at this point.
Go ahead.
Although these aren't places I went to, that's kind of a big caveat, but...
So I want to sort of transition into the regional and the international reaction to this.
Okay.
I want to start with IGAD, the I have it in my notes. The Intergovernmental Authority on Development. And,
yep.
And so, so apparently they met today, and they're talking about deploying more peacekeepers, East African peacekeepers, to this area. And I think in our previous conversation with Leslie Ann Warner, and sort of the argument she has made and sort of written about is that, you know, within IGAD, you have Uganda, who has sort of has been the leader, if I understand it correctly, has been sort of, you know, by day sort of pushes for peace, and then by night,
yeah,
you know, sort of is, you know, the main intervener and sort of the country with the most physical presence within South Sudan. So, I mean, walk us through sort of, you know, in your experience being on the ground, what is sort of what has been IGAD's sort of involvement in South Sudan?
So IGAD is in the process of setting up some kind of a multi-country monitoring team that will be based in Juba in order to keep track of how the ceasefire is going, mm-hmm. And kind of monitor the, you know, the actions of either side. And I think that includes like envoys from each of the IGAD countries, you know, mostly like high level military people from Ethiopia, Sudan, Uganda, and so on. More directly, what you're getting at is the fact that the Ugandans still have not as many troops as they had maybe a couple months ago. They're drawing down in some respects, but I mean, they're right there at the airport in Juba. They're right there. They have tanks in place on either end of the runway. They have infantry that are based at the airport. They have shooting blinds that they've sort of set up at the end of one of the runways. They've got attack and transport helicopters. Again, this is not a lot of soldiers, but this is like a pretty serious show of force. And there are kind of two schools of thought about this. The U.S. and I believe a couple of European countries have actually called on Uganda to withdraw its troops from South Sudan. I believe that that has something to do with the fact that they want Uganda to appear to be an honest broker, you know, since IGAD has really stepped in and trying to sort this whole mess out in a way that the U.S. and, you know, the European powers have not. And of course, IGAD is better equipped to deal with this than we are. But still, you know, we want at least the appearance of as honest and as balanced a peace process as possible. The counter argument to that is that the Ugandans were invited by what we still consider to be the legitimate democratically elected government of South Sudan. And one of the hard and fast rules of, you know, the use of force, you know, in international politics is that if a military has been invited, it's completely legal for it to be there. I mean, this is what made, for instance, the French intervention in Mali legal, right? If a government invites you, you can have soldiers there. And also, you know, the fact that were it not for the Ugandans, it's possible that Juba would have been completely lost and burned to the ground back in December. And the fact that there are still Ugandan assets in the capital all but ensures that Juba will not fall, at least not to the rebels. And at least not because of anything other than, you know, kind of internal chaos. So, I mean, I think that the Ugandan issue is maybe less of a challenge than it was. But, you know, you still hear stories about how, oh, Museveni gets a cut of South Sudan's oil revenues, or about how, you know, Uganda is kind of in the process of trying to turn South Sudan into like a serious kind of, you know, zone of interest for themselves, you know, and that their military presence has something to do with larger kind of geopolitical designs. You know, that may well be, but, you know, I think based on the prevailing standards, Uganda's presence is probably legal and legitimate. It's just a question of, you know, the appearance of bias or meddling as IGAD tries to, you know, to work towards something.
Then I'm sort of curious. I mean, if you don't mind, can we sort of examine Uganda's motive? I mean, it seems like, you know, the countries in IGAD, you know, would be Uganda, Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Djibouti, and South Sudan. And I mean, Kenya and Ethiopia's military is pretty, I mean, you know, it's not the United States military, but they're significant. So, you know, why so much interest for a physical presence coming out of Uganda as opposed to Kenya, who has, you know, just as much business interests in Uganda,
yeah,
in South Sudan. So I'm sort of curious.
Well, part of it is probably historic. Uganda supported, you know, the SPLM pretty much for the entirety of its history, I think. And not only do they do that, but the North supported the LRA. North Sudan, Khartoum, supported the LRA as a sort of retaliation for Museveni's support of the SPLM. So, in a way, the country has been destabilized to an extent as a kind of blowback from their policy in South Sudan. I think that Uganda sort of fancies itself as one of the kind of rising superpowers, you know, regional powers in Central and East Africa, which explains kind of why they've gotten so involved in, you know, Somalia, for instance, a place where they might not seem to have a lot of direct interests. Certainly, you know, the Ugandans have a vested interest in having some kind of stability on that border. They have a lot of citizens. There are a lot of Ugandan citizens in South Sudan. The one highway, sort of the one real paved highway in South Sudan, leads from Juba to the Ugandan border. You know, any commercial good that you get in Juba has been trucked through Uganda at some point. Or at least most of it, I would assume. So it's, you know, it's viewed as an area of, and remember, South Sudan is not a poor country, right? This is a country with oil, with potential uranium and gold. It's a place that eventually, hopefully one of these days, is going to have the kind of massive agricultural development that it needs to really have a viable, sustainable economy. And I think that if you're Museveni, you're certainly better off with the country being under a kind of pseudo-stability under the SPLM than you are with kind of a full-on civil war, which gets it at kind of a larger, very kind of, you know, perplexing issue with South Sudan, which is the government, you know, that's currently in power has made all sorts of baffling and counterproductive decisions, undoubtedly, from, you know, its refusal to really reform itself to peddling this ridiculous story about a coup, to kind of, you know, increasingly dictatorial tendencies, things like, you know, restrictions on the media and, you know, just their hostility towards the UN in recent months, culminating with, you know, Salva Kiir's statement back in February that the UN was akin to kind of a foreign occupier who was setting up a parallel state structure in South Sudan. You know, you could argue that the government has done a lot, maybe less, but maybe even as much as Riak to kind of bring the country to this crisis point. But the country's only 2 years old. This is a government that you can't really expect a guerrilla movement to kind of morph itself into a responsible democratic government in this short of a period of time. And the fact that there is kind of a government in place that is recognized as legitimate and democratically elected provides at least the basis for some kind of future, you know, development or some kind of future liberalization. So, you know, the question is, you know, for countries like the United States, is how do you push the South Sudanese government in a more responsible direction while keeping your expectations realistic and without potentially further destabilizing the situation? You know, recognizing that Salva Kiir is not a perfect leader, that he might make decisions that actually make things worse, without completely giving up on the government in a way that threatens to send the country spiraling into even worse chaos. And that's the tough moral and policy quandary for the U.S. and for, you know, the donor nations in South Sudan right now.
So that was a perfect bridge. I mean, let's talk about what has been U.S. policy in your view of, you know, towards South Sudan. I mean, I think like a month ago, they were telling Uganda, you know, sort of get out. you know, withdraw your troops or reduce your troop presence. I mean, what would you consider, at least as far as this administration is concerned, sort of their policy towards South Sudan?
So Bush obviously was close personal friends with Salva Kiir. South Sudanese, solving the North-South issue in Sudan was one of his top foreign policy priorities anywhere in the world, really. It's something that he attacked from the beginning of his presidency, and, you know, really brought the parties to a point in 2005 where they could make peace with one another to an extent, or at least to an extent that they had not been able to in previous years or decades. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that Bush really hit on the South Sudan issue in a fairly aggressive way. I mean, Bush is considered, and I don't want to say that, you know, there are statues of him, and, you know, it's not like in Albania where there's statues of George W. Bush. There's no statue of Bush in Juba. But when I was there a couple of years ago, you could get, you know, American flags on the street. They're certainly very mindful of what the U.S. did in order to bring them to the point where they're independent.
Doesn't Salva Kiir wear a hat that was given to him by Bush?
I mean, yeah, he wears a Stetson that Bush gave him. I mean, I think he has more than one Stetson, but the original of the Stetsons was given him by Bush.
Oh, okay.
The trouble is that Obama does not have, I mean, this is an issue with Obama all over the world. With Bush, you had these very close personal relationships with foreign leaders, which would sometimes get him into huge trouble, right? Vladimir Putin, looking into Putin's soul, that kind of thing. Obama, you know, Obama doesn't tend to boast about being able to look into foreign leaders' souls. On the other hand, his relationship with Kiir and with the SPLM leadership in general is a lot colder than Bush's was. Even though there are people like Susan Rice, you know, in the Obama administration who are known South Sudan people and who have been for a very long time. But the level of kind of personal commitment isn't there. And Obama's policy towards Sudan has been very kind of convoluted from the very, you know, from the beginning, you know, including things like the appointment of Scott Gratian as Sudan envoy, someone who is viewed as really wanting to take a more conciliatory, more engagement-based approach with Khartoum. I mean, his tenure as envoy was, I think it's thought of as being somewhat of a disaster, although not quite as disastrous as his tenure as as ambassador to Kenya. I mean, about a year ago, the Obama administration invited the former head of the Sudanese intelligence services to Washington, which was something that a lot of activists opposed. I believe the invitation was later rescinded. I'm not sure if it had to do with the outcry or with, but point being, it seemed as if the Obama administration wanted to go the engagement route with the North, or at least wanted to test it. The Bush administration did, you know, tested it as well in certain respects. In fact, arguably, sort of the narrative of U.S.-Sudanese relations during the Bush period is that Bush promised them, you know, fully rehabilitated relations with the United States if they could solve the South issue. And then Darfur happened, and relations were kind of thrown back into a period of uncertainty and hostility. You know, Sudan is still considered a state sponsor of terror, so on and so forth. So it's a combination of, I guess, a more conciliatory approach towards the North for the first part of his presidency, combined with kind of the lack of warmth and personal experience with the SPLM. You know, that's resulted in at least the perception that Obama is a bit more aloof on this issue. Certainly, I don't think that people at the U.S. Embassy would see it this way, but it does seem as if the U.S. has not really been in much of a rush to, you know, bring our diplomatic presence back to where it was before December 15th. Our embassy is, I think we have an ambassador. We've got a few officers working under the ambassador. We have numerous soldiers who are guarding the embassy and a few people from USAID, and that's it. There's still a lot of staffers who have not returned. We're not really all that present in trying to sort out, you know, this latest crisis. at least not in a way that some people think we should be. So, I mean, you could say or you could argue that we're trying to send a message to the government, trying to tell them that our goodwill is not infinite, and that if, you know, they don't take a potential rupture in relations with the U.S. seriously, that we are just going to kind of throw up our hands and say the hell with it, with the whole current kind of crop of South Sudanese leaders. There's a potential shift happening in the UN mission as well, when a kind of a parallel shift, when its mandate is up next year. There's the possibility that it turns from an assistance mission into a stabilization mission, in which case the UN's official presence in South Sudan would no longer be on, you know, with the aim of working with the government. It would effectively become, you know, a neutral mission in a way that it hasn't been before. So there's just a lot of kind of frustration with the current leadership in South Sudan. And again, I can understand it. I think it reflects a certain lack of perspective in where the country is and should be 2 years after independence, 2.5 years after independence, and after about a solid half century of war. But on the other hand, this is a government that's accused of basically, you know, staging an ethnic pogrom in their capital city. So, you know, it's, again, it's a tough issue from a moral and strategic kind of perspective.
Right.
Just what our relationship with the SPLM should look like at this point.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, help me puzzle through, I mean, why the disinterest? I mean, if we look at sort of, this is the same sort of administration that has, you know, had emphasis on AFRICOM, has sort of, I don't want to say the pivot to Africa, but I mean...
Yeah, the Africa pivot.
You know, their increased sort of presence and interest. I mean, it almost seems like you're describing that there's this, you know, diplomatic sort of disinterest, but at the same time, this very much military...
Yeah,
you know, as you know, evidenced by AFRICOM, sort of you know, interest in the continent and in particular, you know, East Africa and sort of.
Well, I think part of it is again a frustration and a weariness with South Sudan. I mean, back in 2012, when South Sudan sent troops to Hejliege, the oil producing region, the disputed, semi-disputed oil producing region in the North Sudan. I mean, Susan Rice threatened, when the U.S. held the presidency of the Security Council, Susan Rice threatened to sanction both parties. She spoke very even-handedly about responsibility and potential reprisals for both parties, which I thought was kind of astounding considering that South Sudan is a U.S. ally, or at least back then was considered, you know, a no-brainer U.S. ally. And I think that just the government, the current government has proven so recalcitrant in terms of its relations with the U.S. and the international community in general, that there's, you know, a lot of frustration and not a sense of really wanting to go to bat for them. And in terms of our military interests in South Sudan, they're not great. We don't have bases there. There aren't terrorists there. I mean, we have helped train the SPLA in demining. I think there probably is still some U.S. training of South Sudanese military personnel and kind of non-lethal stuff. At least, you know, I'll have to look into that, but I think that we're still doing that kind of training. Aside from that, it's just not a place that's super important to the U.S.'s defense posture. You know, it's not as important as Burkina Faso or Eastern Ethiopia or Djibouti, certainly. And at least during the crisis back in December, the main objective of the U.S. was to make sure that none of our citizens got killed. I mean, there was one very unfortunate circumstance in which several Marines, in which the White Army opened fire on Marines in, was it Bor? It was somewhere in the Northeast when we were trying to evacuate our citizens back in late December. And I think a couple of those Marines were actually somewhat badly injured. But aside from that, you know, our main objective when the crisis broke out, it seemed, was to just not have another Benghazi-type situation, which, you know, we succeeded in doing, you know, because of some incredible efforts from the embassy and from the Obama administration. You know, but there was a conscious effort, I believe, you know, to not lose any additional you know, U.S. personnel or U.S. citizens in South Sudan, and that's kind of what the main objective was, at least as the crisis unfolded.
So I want to maybe change our footing a little and discuss the future of South Sudan. I mean, it seems like, you know, just doing research for this interview, it seems like there's a impending humanitarian crisis. You know, there's the tyranny, not the tyranny, but sort of, you know, the dominance of outsiders and sort of their internal affairs. I mean, what does the future of South Sudan look like?
So there's the, I guess you can look at it on two separate tracks. In the near to midterm, it doesn't look great. When the rains hit, all the roads are going to wash out. It's going to be very difficult to get humanitarian aid from place to place. It's going to be pretty much impossible to get humanitarian aid to people who are inside of rebel-held areas. It's already very difficult. There were reports a few weeks ago of Dinka fleeing into North Sudan, into southern Kordofan, where, of course, there's already a war going on. So if things are really that bad now, when the rains hit, they're going to get even worse. I think one NGO type person who I talked to in Juba estimated that there are going to be between, I want to say, about a population of 1 million in which there is sort of an acute hunger scenario, in which I think is technically defined as starvation or hunger in one out of every five people. So, which is not a famine. It's on the same track as famine, but it's not quite, I mean, it's probably somewhat alarmist to say that a famine could happen this year in 2014. The real worry, according to people I've talked to, is 2015. It's a year from now, after you go through an entire year of disrupted supply lines, of people being unable to access their land, of lower agricultural output, and, you know, kind of chronic displacement. It's 2015, and just the lack of infrastructure and difficulty of accessing people. You know, you're looking at a potential kind of famine scenario in 2015, along with the, you know, an acute hunger scenario preceding that during the rainy season this year. There's a period known as kind of a hunger gap. I don't think that this is a phrase specific to South Sudan, but I heard it, a few times when I was there this past week, which describes the months during the summer when there's no cultivation and when food stocks are running low. So the kind of hunger gap period in, you know, July, August this year is probably going to be pretty brutal in parts of the country. And, of course, there's the political sort of situation, which hasn't really been figured out yet. On the other hand, I heard from more than one person, South Sudanese and not, that this whole situation is teaching the country some much-needed lessons. And that it's really going to be, I mean, this sounds kind of callous considering how many people have died, but it's really a kind of learning experience in a way. It's teaching people what not to do, and it could create a sense of urgency for really solving a lot of problems that did not get solved during the interim period and during independence. You know, it could create the urgency needed for a national level kind of reconciliation effort. It could, you know, force the SPLM to really take internal reform and democratization seriously. And, you know, in the end, there's always been a lot more upside to South Sudan than I think people realize. You know, it's not just the oil, it's the fact that, you know, a lot of people have come back from the country to the country since independence, including people who were educated in Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia. There's the potential for year-round agriculture. I mean, South Sudan is one of the largest wetlands in Africa. It's right next door to Kenya and Uganda and Ethiopia and countries that are sort of growing economies, growing kind of regional powers. And South Sudan sits kind of right on the border between, you know, the the Arab kind of Muslim Arabic-speaking world to the north, and, you know, the Anglophone African world of the south, right? I mean, it's a country, it's likely, I would assume, the only non-Muslim country in the world, where just about you know, where Arabic is a lingua franca. You know, Juba Arabic is, you know, and it's not just Juba Arabic, it's people from the South who lived in the North during the war, who grew up speaking Arabic, who have now returned South. I mean, there's a real kind of Arabic-speaking culture in South Sudan. It's a place that could really kind of serve as a bridge between, you know, two very kind of different regions, economically, socially, politically, everything else. So in the long run, so long as I think people don't give up on it, so long as it isn't written off as another CAR or another Somalia, I think, you know, the future is potentially bright. And of course, that's not to slag Somalia, where I also think the future is bright, incidentally. but it's a, you know, it's a thing where people have to take a step back, right? The country is only 2 years old. It's dealing with problems that are incredibly difficult for even a very mature kind of political and social, you know, political culture to handle. And, you know, the way that one expat put it, I met with a guy who's lived in South Sudan for literally decades. And the way he put it is, it's not great, but it's been worse, you know?
Interesting. So I think you, we've covered a lot today.
Yeah. Hopefully I've been making some sense. I slept about 12 hours yesterday trying to overcome some jet lag. So, hopefully I'm not too loopy over here.
No. So before we go, we always, you know, give the guest the last word. And so, you know, leave us with something to think about, to chew on, you know, to mollify our fears, I guess.
Okay. Well, I mean, again, like, it's just got to be remembered that, you know, it's a very young country. It's a country that's coming off of really, you know, it was forged through one of the worst conflicts of kind of the latter quarter of the 20th century. And, you know, even if the current kind of leadership is imperfect, even if there are some serious kind of moral qualms with supporting them, there is something to be said for following a process that, you know, could eventually lead to something normal and stable. Which, you know, could take a long time. But again, there's this, I mean, I've seen it just in, you know, in back when I really paid close attention to what was going on in Egypt. Now I don't, because it's just exhausting and highly repetitive. But particularly in the post kind of Arab Spring period, there's an expectation that every country is going to be like Tunisia. You know, the government's going to fall within a few weeks. There's going to be a plan in place for what's going to happen afterwards. And then everything's going to be sort of, I mean, that hasn't happened. That's not describing what's happened in Tunisia, but, you know, just kind of an expectation that things will be neat and that they'll kind of wrap themselves up quickly. And there isn't as much patience for long kind of multi-step, you know, political sagas that could last for not just 2 or 3 years, but for 20 or 30. You know, Egypt, for instance, could be in the middle of a process that is going to unspool for the next several decades, not just for a few years. And I think South Sudan has to be looked at in the same kind of light, where it could take, you know, a relatively long time before the country begins to settle into a normal kind of existence in which people have a sense of national identity and a sense of national responsibility, and where there is kind of you know, an educated and socially engaged polity that's capable of moving things forward. That will happen. I'm sure it will happen, but the world needs to be patient and kind of realistic, I think.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me on once again.
No problem.
And, yeah.
Thanks.